Google opened its Worldwide Developers Conference yesterday, and it came with a few announcements. The most notable is the company's entry into the highly competitive tablet market. As NPR's Lara Seidel reports, with the Nexus 7, Google is headed for a market somewhere between the Amazon Fire and Apple's iPad.
It's called the Nexus 7 because it's a 7-inch tablet. Google also announced more content for its online store. In addition to music, movies, and books, they'll have TV shows and magazines.
We wanted a device that lets you immerse yourself in all of that media.
Google's Hugo Barra.
We wanted you to be delighted when you read books, magazines, watch movies, and play games.
Clearly, Google is hoping to compete with the Kindle Fire, which is meant for buying and consuming content from Amazon's store. But Google threw in some features that make it a little more competitive, better graphics, a camera, and at $200, it's cheaper than an iPad. Forrester analyst Frank Gillette.
So it'll be people who aren't yet tied up with any of those ecosystems who will say, oh, you know, that looks like a pretty cool tablet. Let me try that.
And there's probably some room. Gillette expects the tablet market to grow from 191 million devices this year to 760 million in 2016. Google also showed off computerized glasses. As the presentation was happening, a group of parachuters wearing them jumped out of a blimp over the Moscone Center in San Francisco. The audience was able to see it on a screen live in an auditorium as if they were looking through the glasses. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
In the world of smartphones, two giants, Apple and Samsung, have been going head-to-head, and the competition could get rougher. Samsung just launched a new smartphone in the U.S., and it could be a serious threat to the iPhone. To find out more, we called Rich Jaroslawski. He is gadget reviewer and technology columnist for Bloomberg News. Rich, good to talk to you again.
Great to be here.
Now, I understand that you have been test driving this new gadget, the Samsung Galaxy S3. Is this another iPhone wannabe, or is it something that might be better?
Well, it's an iPhone wannabe that also sets a marker for the next iPhone. Samsung is launching it simultaneously on all the U.S. carriers, and it's substantially larger than the iPhone, but it's also thinner and lighter than the current iPhone. So it really, the form factor of it is really quite striking.
So can it do any good tricks, anything that iPhone doesn't do?
There are a couple of things. The big thing that I found when I was using it is that the Verizon and AT&T versions of this phone run on networks that are called LTE. Now, these are the fastest data networks in the U.S., and it means that web pages download very quickly. If you're doing anything involving the Internet, it's much swifter than the current iPhone 4S. Now, the expectation is that the next iPhone, which will probably be out in the fall, will be able to do LTE as well. But for right now, the Samsung S3 has it really beat in the speed category.
So faster, lighter, larger. What about features?
Well, that's where you start to get into the explanation for why the iPhone is so powerful. Because although there are a lot of features and Samsung's packed a lot of technology into this device, as they often do, some of them don't work as well. Some of them are kind of geeky.
Define geeky feature. Examples.
Well, they have something that they are introducing called tech tiles, which cost a little extra. They're stickers, and embedded in the sticker is a chip called an NFC chip, which is also in the phone. And what you can do is to program the stickers so that if you swipe the phone past one of them, the phone will do something. For example, you could program a tile and put it up on your door if you have a latchkey child who comes home when no one else is home. The child could swipe his or her phone next to the tile, and the tile would immediately, the phone rather, would immediately send a text to mom that says, "Hi, mom, I'm home."
Huh. I don't know whether I'd like that or not.
Well, there's a certain category of user, and unfortunately, I suspect I'm probably one of them, who finds that utterly fascinating. But I do wonder if normal human beings would be willing to devote the patience to getting it programmed to do just what you want it to do.
What about the price? How does the Samsung Galaxy S3 compare to the iPhone on price?
It is very comparable to the iPhone 4S. There are more variations in the iPhone in terms of how much you can store on it, but the comparable devices are dollar for dollar pretty much equivalent.
Now, Apple obviously gets a lot of attention, and it has very sort of high-powered publicity tactics. But if you look at the numbers, doesn't Samsung actually sell more smartphones around the world than Apple does?
If you look, I think in the first quarter numbers, Samsung had about a 29% global market share, Apple about 24%. Now, in the U.S., which is the most important smartphone market, those numbers are reversed. But the fact is that between the two of them, Apple and Samsung pretty much control about all the profits there are to be had in the mobile phone business.
And Samsung can always lean back on the fact that it has dumb phones that are making a lot of money for the company.
Exactly. If you expand the universe beyond smartphones to look at all wireless phones, Samsung has a big lead worldwide. But the growth and the money are all in that smartphone segment, and that's where all the manufacturers are trying to pile in right now.
Rich Jaroslawski is technology columnist for Bloomberg News. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's stay on Samsung for a moment. Before it sold smartphones and other electronics, it started as a company which sold dry fish and fruit. That was more than 70 years ago.
Now Samsung sells everything from life insurance to chemicals, along with those phones. It's one of South Korea's biggest companies.
And it's still run by the same family, the Lees. The thing is, some members of the Lee family don't get along.
And that brings us to today's last word in business, family feud. When the founder of Samsung passed away in the late 1980s, his assets were divided among his three children. Now, the youngest son, 70-year-old chairman Lee Kun-hee of Samsung Electronics, is being sued by his older brother and sister.
They argue they didn't receive their fair share of the inheritance, that the youngest Lee concealed assets. They want their little brother to hand over an $800 million stake in the group.
According to Business Week, the younger Lee has said he has no intention to give even a dime to his brother, whom he calls disloyal to their father. He also called his sister a whiner. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. In this week's Look Ahead with NPR's Laura Seidel, another nail in the coffin for Kodak.
You know, I feel like you should bring on the violins for that one.
Cue the sad music.
Today begins this very sad process. It's really the end of an era.
The Kodak era. The company filed for bankruptcy back in January. The news today is that Kodak will begin to transfer 5 billion of its customers' online photos to the company Shutterfly.
And all of those Kodak customers, those 68 million U.S. and Canadian customers, will no longer be customers of Kodak. They will be customers of Shutterfly.
Now, Kodak customers won't be able to access their photos for a while, but users will eventually get them all back. As for the company, well, it'll always be remembered for its yellow boxes of film, Brownie and Instamatic cameras, and, as you might recall from a popular scene in Mad Men, a certain slide projector.
It's called the carousel. It lets us travel the way a child travels. Round and around, back home again, to a place where we know we are loved.
Kodak stopped making projectors in 2004. And that look back to Kodak's glory days is our look ahead to this week's tech news with NPR's Laura Seidel. Now to a review of a mobile app called PlaceMe, created by the company Aloha Mobile. As long as it's running, the app keeps an automatic log of the places you visited. But it's different from some other location-based apps.
You're basically sharing it only with yourself. It's a private memory bank of all the places that you've gone.
That's Alexis Madrigal, senior editor at The Atlantic, who decided to take the PlaceMe app for a spin around the block.
The idea is that it's sort of a perfect memory. You know, if you're like me, you don't necessarily remember where you went three Tuesdays ago. And so you can track this kind of data to say, like, do I go to the gym more often than I go to the ice cream shop, or vice versa, right? You are, in fact, making a location log that would be very easy for someone using your phone to look into. You know, just like all privacy things, maybe it's no big deal. On the other hand, maybe that information ends up somewhere you don't want it to. Right now, I'm in my house, which is on the border between Oakland and Berkeley, and I was going to head to a coffee shop and see if PlaceMe would actually pick me up. Here I go. All right, I'll put on a little bit of the head and the heart. Maybe a little sunroof, too. Oh, hey, how's it going? Can I just get a large iced coffee?
To go.
Thank you. I was able to take a look at where PlaceMe automatically deposited my location into a database. And unfortunately, it did not deposit the wonderful coffee shop into the database. Instead, it placed where I parked my car, which just happens to be a random side street. I think as a one-time experiment, it kind of shows one of the general problems with PlaceMe, which is just that given the current technological limitations, it takes human intervention to create a perfect record of what it is that you've done with your life. And maybe it's best seen as an aid to what you might want to remember rather than a replacement for your actual mind.
That's Alexis Madrigal, senior editor at The Atlantic.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
The University of Virginia may have settled its most urgent controversy by reinstating President Teresa Sullivan after initially forcing her out. But one of the issues behind her ouster is still unresolved, namely, whether the university was too slow to join the movement into online education. As NPR's Tobias Smith reports, many other schools are still assessing the value of web-based courses.
Rollins College in Florida was one of the early pioneers in online learning as one of 16 Southern schools using technology to share courses and professors. Rollins president Lewis Duncan says it's easy to understand how neighbors may be fretting about not keeping up with the whizzes.
There is the old saying that for any organization, when the outside world is changing faster than the inside world, you're moving backwards.
Add in the financial pressure on universities and their need to find new ways of doing business, and it's not hard to see how anxiousness could turn to panic, especially with each new venture launched, from Coursera with Stanford, Princeton, and others, to Harvard and MIT's online giant called edX.
Certainly, it got everyone's attention, and I think schools that don't try and find their place in that will be left behind.
In this sequence, we are going to look at a whole bunch of techniques for analyzing circuits.
While it used to be just a relative few who paid MIT tens of thousands in tuition could take Electronics 6002, today anyone in the world can take Electronics 6002X online for free. Last semester, about 160,000 did, and about 7,000 passed.
You know, I like to call it flipping the funnel.
That's edX president Anant Agarwal.
You know, what we're doing now is expanding the mission. You know, so now everybody has an equal opportunity to come in the big end of the funnel. And if they can cut it, they can get a certificate at the end of it and, you know, pass the course.
Agarwal's the first to concede that giving education away for free is not a sustainable business model. But this is just beta testing, he says. Eventually, there are lots of ways to generate revenue. For example, edX could charge for certificates. Or schools could venture into career placement services and make money the way headhunters do.
You know, this is the Wild West. There's a lot of things we have to figure out. And, you know, if anybody says they know exactly what they're doing, I think that would be a far cry from reality.
But the frontier of digital education is also a risky place to be. Schools who go online also put their names on the line.
You run the risk of potentially diluting your brand.
Jason Wingard, vice dean at the Wharton School, says online learning does have great potential, but he says it's hard for schools to offer a free or cheaper version of their product without undermining their customer base.
There becomes a disconnect where the customer doesn't understand the difference. All they understand is that they're giving it away for free over here and they're charging money for it over there.
Many also doubt that employers will ever be as impressed by an online certificate as a traditional college diploma, but acceptance is growing, especially for jobs that require specific skills like computer programming. And there's even a secondary market cropping up around quality control. Jennifer Fremont-Smith founded Smarterer, a company that tests and grades what a job applicant actually knows.
There needs to be a viable third-party credentialing system that employers can trust. And once employers accept that kind of a system, then people can go out and gain their skills in all of those places.
Another knock against online learning is that while it may be good for students who can't afford college, it'll never compare to the on-campus experience. But that may also change as new blended formulas develop, says Stanford professor Terry Moe.
What you have is a mad scramble. It's a certain kind of chaos, but this is a revolution. There's no way this isn't going to transform the way schools are organized.
Many innovations will turn out to be spectacular successes and others spectacular stumbles. But Agarwal from edX says that shouldn't deter anyone.
You know, stumbling and groping in the dark here and trying to figure things out is a good thing. And if you're not stumbling, you should be.
Agarwal says the worst mistake a school could make is sitting still. Tovia Smith, NPR News.